This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Lemony Snicket is back. That's the pen name of our first guest, Daniel Handler, who wrote a series of satirical gothic novels for young adults called A Series of Unfortunate Events. Handler's new book begins another series called All the Wrong Questions. It's a prequel of sorts, in which the 12-year-old Snicket becomes a detective investigating a series of perplexing mysteries. The first book in the series is called Who Could That Be at This Hour? At the heart of the mystery is a precious sculpture that has disappeared, a sculpture of a beast. Think The Maltese Falcon and other noir classics, rewritten as a satire for young adults. In fact, let's hear a scene from the 1941 film The Maltese Falcon. Peter Lorre's character, the mysterious Joel Cairo, is hiring Humphrey Bogart's character, Detective Sam Spade, to find the valuable sculpture known as the Maltese Falcon.
Now, what can I do for you, Mr. Cairo?
See, Mr. Spade, I'm trying to recover ornament that, shall we say, has been mislaid.
Uh-huh.
I thought and hoped you could assist me. The ornament is a statuette, black figure of a bird. I am prepared to pay on behalf of the figure's rightful owner the sum of $5,000 for its recovery. I am prepared to promise that, no questions will be asked.
Now, let's hear a passage inspired by that scene in Daniel Handler's new Lemony Snicket detective novel from when Terry spoke with Handler last Monday.
"I'm in desperate need of your assistance," she began. "A priceless item has been stolen from my home, and I need to get it back." "First," Theodora said, "we'll need to know what the item is." "I know that," the woman snapped. "I was just about to tell you. It's a small statue about the size of a bottle of milk. It's made of an extremely rare species of wood that is very shiny and black in color. The statue has been in my family for generations and has been valued at upward of a great deal of money." "A great deal of money," Theodora repeated thoughtfully. "When was it stolen?" "That I do not know," Mrs. Salas said. "I have not been in this room for quite some time, and normally the statue is kept there in the library, on the mantel over there." We looked at the mantel. Sure enough, there was nothing on it.
Daniel Handler, welcome back to Fresh Air. So when we last left off, you were writing gothic novels for children. Why did you switch now to the detective genre?
Well, towards the end of writing A Series of Unfortunate Events, I just picked up a Raymond Chandler novel, more or less at random, and I found it so magical and so astonishing, and also that the journey of the detective in such the novel and then in other novels that I read that followed seemed to mirror that of childhood, that an outsider is trying to make his way in a mysteriously corrupt world, and that all instructions turn out to be false, that all people turn out to have secrets that are hidden, and that the detective tries to find his own moral stance and own path through that environment. And that seemed to me to be also like the journey of childhood. So I said to myself, if I ever write another series, it will be to noir novels what A Series of Unfortunate Events was to the gothic novel.
So now let's start with a reading from the beginning of your new book, Who Could That Be at This Hour? By Lemony Snicket, a.k.a. Daniel Handler.
There was a town, and there was a girl, and there was a theft. I was living in the town, and I was hired to investigate the theft, and I thought the girl had nothing to do with it. I was almost 13, and I was wrong. I was wrong about all of it. I should have asked the question, why would someone say something was stolen when it was never theirs to begin with? Instead, I asked the wrong question, four wrong questions, more or less. This is the account of the first. The Hemlock Tea Room and Stationery Shop is the sort of place where the floors always feel dirty, even when they are clean. They were not clean on the day in question. The food at the Hemlock is too awful to eat, particularly the eggs, which are probably the worst eggs in the entire city, including those on exhibit at the Museum of Bad Breakfast, where visitors can learn just how badly eggs can be prepared. The Hemlock sells paper and pens that are damaged and useless, but the tea is drinkable, and the place is located across the street from the train station, so it is an acceptable place to sit with one's parents before boarding a train for a new life. I was wearing the suit I'd been given as a graduation present. It had hung in my closet for weeks, like an empty person. I felt glum and thirsty. When the tea arrived, for a moment the steam was all I could see. I'd said goodbye to someone very quickly and was wishing I'd taken longer. I told myself that it didn't matter, and that certainly it was no time to frown around town. "You have work to do, Snicket," I told myself. "There is no time for moping." "You'll see her soon enough in any case," I thought, incorrectly.
And that's Daniel Handler reading from his new Lemony Snicket novel, Who Could That Be at This Hour? Well, I think you found, like, one more connection there between children and detectives. Detectives are always eating bad food at, like, cheap diners. And in this case, it's bad eggs. And children are always being told to eat their eggs. And a lot of kids don't like eggs.
Well, I think bad food is frightening when you're a child. You can't believe that you're being served something that you don't like and that you're expected to eat it.
Oh, and one more connection. Detectives are always being told contradictory things, you know, from all the mysterious people who are misleading them in different directions. And children are always getting advice from adults, and the advice that they get isn't always the same from adult to adult, and it's very confusing.
It is. It's very confusing. You know, one thing that is different since the last time we spoke is that I now have a child.
Who is how old?
And so I'm now forced. He's 9. He's just turned 9. And I'm forced to explain the world to him all the time. And I'm aghast at my own complete failure. I just can't. Yeah. I just realize I have hardly any explanation for anything at all. We were listening to this song by Kraftwerk, We Are the Robots, and he said to me, "Are they pretending to be robots?" And I said, "Yes, they are." And then he said, "Are the Beatles pretending to be Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band?" And I said, "I think they are." And he said, "But aren't they pretending to be Beatles?" And I felt suddenly the knowledge of the world just absolutely slipping out of my brain. I thought, why did they call themselves the Beatles? That doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, one story is that it was a play on Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and they were the Beatles.
Right, but when did musicians started calling themselves things that they weren't?
Like, yes, exactly.
When did that happen, and how do I explain that to my child?
Good luck.
In such a way that it makes sense, let alone, you know, explaining the horrors of the world or anything.
So one thing you can't have in a children's detective book is the kind of sexual sparks that fly between the detective and the femme fatale. And also, the detective is often slipped a Mickey by the villain. And, you know, this is like a Mickey Finn, which is a drink with a drug that's secretly slipped in to
yes.
kind of knock out the guy.
Oh, I know what a Mickey
guy.
Is, Terry Gross.
No, I'm explaining it to anybody who is not familiar with their noir film. But anyways, so in your novel, your children's detective novel, there's a drink with laudanum in it. And I mean, my goodness, laudanum is like an opiate, which you explain.
Yeah.
And what is an opiate doing in your book for children?
Well, I think in some ways it comes out of the same fear of food that we were just discussing, that the novel begins with Lemony Snicket at this Hemlock tea room and stationery shop, and he's being served a cup of tea by people who may or may not be his parents. And it turns out that the tea is laced with something that would knock him unconscious. And I think that that's both fits into the noir tradition of people drinking the wrong thing and ending up unconscious, and into the tradition of childhood in which beverages that you don't know about are scary. And what is scary about them is you imagine some unearthly thing might happen to you.
So not that I object, but do you think some parent is going to think, opiate? I guess you're not worried about that.
I couldn't agree more. As a parent, I strongly urge people not to serve opiates to their children. And I think, if anything, Who Could That Be at This Hour makes a very powerful case for not drugging children. I don't mind getting on a soapbox about this. You shouldn't drug children.
So there's all kinds of, like, references.
Other children's authors have expressed no opinion on this. Where's Beverly Cleary on this issue, I wonder?
So one of the things you've done in your new detective book for children, Who Could That Be at This Hour, is you've revived some really old slang, like, you know, roadster for car, ruffian, And then gimcrack or jimcrack. I've never even known. I've run across this word. I've never known what it means. I've never even been sure how to pronounce gimcrack. So I'm turning to you. What does it mean?
Well, it means a piece of junk, although also sometimes it's used as an adjective. I've seen gimcrack construction. So it can both be a word for kind of a white elephant, for a useless object that someone gives you, but it can also be a synonym for shoddy. But I mean, I like a weird word. So I like reading a book and finding a word that that has fallen out of use. I'm happy to return roadster to the lexicon. If one child mentions roadster when they're talking about their carpool, then I will have won.
Don't count on it.
Well, I don't know. There's an astonishing number of children use the word airsats and penultimate in my presence. So I can only hope that roadster gets added to the list.
Wow, that's amazing, actually.
It is. It's astonishing.
You're always putting in like interesting words that are above the vocabulary level of the children that you're writing for. And you find funny words, funny ways of defining those words in context. So good for you.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's not what I found, certainly when the 12th volume of A Series of Unfortunate Events came out, which was called The Penultimate Peril, I found that there were people who knew what that word meant and there were people who didn't, but that line was not along age lines at all. So I remember there was an article in the newspaper that said it's the penultimate book from the penultimate author. They were just using the word as some kind of placeholder, whereas children learned quickly what it meant and were more quickly to adopt it. I mean, you see failed vocabulary in the adult world so often, and it's often because once you reach a certain age, you're kind of embarrassed to go look up a word if you don't know what it means, and then you just start using it however it feels right. So I think children are less embarrassed to go find out the truth.
My favorite misused words are penultimate, when people think it's the absolute ultimate as opposed to the next to the last, and then bemused when people think it's amused instead of confused.
Right. We used to have an ad from the Hearst Castle taped up to our refrigerator. We had it there for years because it said, "Come have your wedding at the Hearst Castle. Rates include a mandatory tour." And I assume they meant complimentary, but somehow this fantasy that you would be sipping champagne at a wedding at the Hearst Castle, and then would say, "And now it's time for a tour." And you would say, "No, thank you. I'd just rather talk with my friends." And they say, "You don't have a choice in the matter. We're taking you on tour now."
That's really great.
You're going to learn about William Randolph Hearst if it kills you.
I'm going to ask you now. You've brought your accordion with you.
And because I was asked.
Because I asked you. Yes, we asked you because I love accordion. And it's
well, but I have a policy that I only bring it when someone asks me, because the question, "Why haven't you brought your accordion?" is charming. And the question, "Why have you brought your accordion?" is alarming.
So you have a song you wrote especially for your new book, which I
didn't write it.
Oh, you didn't write it. Who wrote it?
Sorry, no. The song was written especially for me by Mr. Stephen Merritt, I'm sure, to many, many Fresh Air listeners as the leader of the Magnetic Fields. He's written a number of songs for me. He wrote more than 13 songs for the 13 volumes of A Series of Unfortunate Events, and he wrote this song for me for Who Could That Be at This Hour? When things explode, we hit the road. Well, it's been a lovely visit. But if we can decode our secret code, it isn't a secret, is it? Dressed a la mode and furbelowed, we're working to change this planet. Now, if we can decode our secret code, it can't be a secret, can it? We never do the carioca, which is a dance that goes like this. But if we did the carioca, it would be heaven, it would be bliss. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Tra-la-tra-la-tra-la-tra-la.
tra la 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 tra la tra la tra la tra.
Bravo. that was really great.
Much.
Oh, wow. That is so much fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to do that in a Barnes & Noble outside Philadelphia or an elementary school in Albuquerque.
So how did you start playing accordion?
Well, I played piano my whole life. And when I got to college, I wanted to be in a band. And it was during a strange moment in American pop music when no keyboard instruments were cool. If I'd lugged around a synthesizer, I would have been scorned. And so I took up the accordion. So I like to say that I'm one of the few people in the history of the world to take up the accordion basically in order to meet women.
Did it work?
I did, in fact, meet my wife in college. So there you go.
Because of the accordion?
No. But in fact, I think the accordion was probably a drawback. But but all's well that ends well. Yeah, and the accordion is... Well, I mean, one nice thing is that if you play the accordion, you're probably the best accordion player anybody knows. And so I've had opportunities as a result of playing the accordion, despite not being very good, that never would have come my way if I played some more ordinary instrument.
So did you ever play accordion favorites like Lady of Spain and Beer Barrel Polka? Or since you were already a musician, could you like skip right past that?
I skipped right past most of the beginning accordion tunes, but I mean, I was in a band that played a lot of polkas. I was in a tango band, a klezmer band, a kind of country western band, and I mean, if you play the accordion, you can really play almost any kind of music.
And to prove that, I'm now going to ask you something that is very unaccordion.
Is this Stump the Author?
Stump the Author? Yes. I'm going to ask you to play something that we would never think of as being perfect for accordion, but you have made it work.
Oh, okay.
Dig, if you will, a picture of you and I engaged in a kiss. The sweat of your body covers me. Can you, my darling, can you picture, dream, if you will, a courtyard? An ocean of violets and blue. Animals strike curious poses. They feel the heat between me. And how can you just leave me standing alone in a world so cold? Maybe I'm just too demanding. Maybe I'm just like my father. Too bold, maybe I'm just like your mother. She's never satisfied. Why do we scream at each other? This is what it sounds like when doves cry.
Prince
That's
would have loved it.
Song.
Has Prince heard you do that?
I'm not aware of his doing it. I assume if he had and disapproved, I'd be dead by now. That's what I understand from The Power of Prince. So either he hasn't heard it or he's heard it and liked it.
That's really great.
But that's kind of my go-to. Sometimes someone will learn I play the accordion at a dinner party or something, and then they'll have an accordion in their closet and they'll say, take it and play something. And that's what I play. And then there's never, ever a cry for an encore after that. Everyone says, he's made his point, whatever that point might be.
In 2013, you have a new book coming out that's for younger children, maybe like 3 to 5
or
something.
Well, the new
like
book
that.
Is a picture book.
Yeah.
Yeah. With John Clausen, an illustrator I've long admired.
And it's a wonderful little book. It's all about a child's fear of the dark. And I'd love it if you could read the opening of this forthcoming book,
Certainly.
Which is called The Dark.
Laszlo was afraid of the dark. The dark lived in the same house as Laszlo, a big place with a creaky roof, smooth, cold windows, and several sets of stairs. Sometimes the dark hid in the closet. Sometimes it sat behind the shower curtain. But mostly it spent its time in the basement. All day long, the dark would wait in a distant corner, far from the squeaks and rattles of the washing machine, pressed up against some old, damp boxes and a chest of drawers nobody ever opened. At night, of course, the dark went out and spread itself against the windows and doors of Laszlo's house. But in the morning, the dark would be back in the basement, where it belonged. Laszlo would peek at the dark every morning. "Hi," he would say. "Hi, dark." Laszlo thought that if he visited the dark in the dark's room, maybe the dark wouldn't come visit him in his room. But one night it did.
What scared you as a child?
Oh, everything. Tall trees. Yeah, people in tall trees climbing up to the top of them and leaping upon my window. That was a large source of concern for me. Kidnapping. I remember when my mother finally explained to me that it would be extremely unlikely I would get kidnapped because they didn't really have any money, that kidnappers were after money. And so the idea that you would be kidnapped was very rare if you didn't have money. That was just such a relief to me. I wish that had been explained to me years previously. That she said, "Oh, you know, no one wants. We don't have enough money. We couldn't possibly pay ransom for you. That would be rewarding for a kidnapper. So you probably won't be snatched up." That was of intense relief.
That's great.
And so sometimes when children are standing in line at a SNCCC event while I'm making small talk with them, I ask if they've ever been kidnapped. And they never have. And then I say, "Well, do you have parents who would pay a lot of money for your safe return?" And then we try to figure out exactly what sum of money that is. You know, it's under the guise of whether I'm calculating enough. So if it seems like enough money for me to kidnap them. But I hope that it's also reassuring when they realize they probably won't be kidnapped. There's probably just not enough money at stake.
What if you're talking to a wealthy kid and you'd scare the heck out of him because his parents would have enough money?
Well, I always say, "Have you been kidnapped?" And then I often say, "Have you ever been locked in the trunk of a car?" And then, "Do you like trying new things?" Those are kind of the three questions.
Oh, gosh. It's just really been a pleasure to have you back on Fresh Air. Thank you for performing and for reading from your books. And I wish you good luck with your new book, Who Could That Be at This Hour, and your forthcoming book next year, The Dark.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Daniel Handler, who goes by the pen name Lemony Snicket, speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. You can read an excerpt of Daniel Handler's new Lemony Snicket novel, Who Could That Be at This Hour?, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Zero Dark 30 is the new film about the hunt for Osama bin Laden. It's from Catherine Bigelow, director of 2008's The Hurt Locker. The film opens December 19th, but already has generated controversy over the depiction of the CIA's use of torture. David Edelstein has this review.
Catherine Bigelow's Kill Bin Laden thriller Zero Dark 30 is cool, brisk, and packed with impressively real-sounding intelligence jargon. It presents itself as a work of journalism. Just the facts, ma'am. But there's no doubting its perspective. It's the story of America's brilliant, righteous revenge. The prologue is a black screen with sounds of 9/11, a hubbub of confusion, and then, most terribly, the voice of a woman crying out to a 911 operator who tries vainly to assure her she'll be okay. The recording is genuine. What follows takes place 2 years later at an off-the-grid CIA black site. An Al-Qaeda prisoner is strung up and waterboarded by a big, bearded agent named Dan, played by Jason Clarke. It's brutal and ugly, and the film's protagonist, a newly transferred CIA operative named Maya, played by Jessica Chastain, quietly registers horror. But after that 9/11 prologue, the prisoner's treatment doesn't seem wrong. More important, the information Dan extracts from that man, after more attempts and a bit of subterfuge, will lead over the next decade to bin Laden's courier, who will lead to bin Laden. This week, I've been caught up in controversy over a magazine review I wrote of Zero Dark 30, which I called both phenomenal, the best movie of the year, and morally problematic. I've been attacked from both sides as either too knee-jerk liberal about torture or too tolerant of pro-torture propaganda. But the jury is out on whether the Courier intel came from torture. Senator Dianne Feinstein and author Peter Bergen say no. Author Mark Bowden and Zero Dark 30 screenwriter Mark Bowles' CIA sources say yes. For her part, Kathryn Bigelow has never been a filmmaker with a strong moral point of view. The Hurt Locker begins with a quote from iconoclastic journalist Chris Hedges, likening war to an addictive drug. Bigelow identifies with adrenaline addicts, most often men, but here a woman, although a woman whose role in the story is to be more macho than the men. She has to bully colleagues publicly humiliated after the failure of WMD Iraq intelligence to take risks now in the name of catching bin Laden. She's the one who tells Navy SEALs in an airplane hangar the object of their mission.
You'll notice the stealth panels, similar to what we use on the B-2. The rotors have been muffled with decibel killers. It's slower than a Black Hawk, lacks the offense and the stability, but it can hide.
So, excuse me, but what do we need this for in Libya? I mean, Gaddafi's anti-air is virtually non-existent.
Maya, you want to brief them?
There are two narratives about the location of Osama bin Laden. The one that you're most familiar with is that UBL is hiding in a cave in the tribal areas, that he's surrounded by a large contingent of loyal fighters. But that narrative is pre-9/11 understanding of UBL. The second narrative is that he's living in a city. Living in a city with multiple points of egress and entry, access to communications, so that he can keep in touch with the organization. You can't run a global network of interconnected cells from a cave.
There's been speculation Maya was inspired by the same covert CIA agent as Claire Danes' bipolar Carrie in Homeland, but the parts and actresses could hardly be more different. Chastain is stripped down to pure will. You know what she's feeling by the tension in her body. Killing bin Laden has become a religious quest, a counter-jihad, and she's frustrated that so much of her job comes down to pitching, as in Hollywood. There's always another professionally skeptical CIA bureaucrat to be sold on the probable whereabouts of the courier. Then he'll have to sell his superior, who'll have to sell the commander-in-chief. Bigelow makes those pitches hum. She's a wizard at alternating fast-moving, streaky shots with shots that suddenly give you your bearings, so you're always one step behind, rushing to catch up. In the incredibly tense climax, the SEALs' night vision goggles turn the compound green. The camera follows them through doors and upstairs, the only sound the bouncing of equipment, the bleeding of sheep, and then, after the firing begins, the sobbing of children. The carnage is quick and conclusive. Bigelow doesn't serve up a Hollywood shootout, and the way the SEALs pump extra bullets into prone bodies, among them bin Laden's, is disturbing. But for all the supposed neutrality and the sad, ambiguous final shot, the ending is happy. We got him. After 9/11, Dick Cheney said to fight terrorists, America had to embrace the dark side. And Kathryn Bigelow has given that dark side a woman's blessing. Zero Dark Thirty is mercilessly gripping, a great thriller. But it's not a great work of art. To be divided about it is not to be wishy-washy. It's to say, I'm blown away by this. But given the larger implications of this event, is that enough?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed the new film, Zero Dark Thirty. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Beer is great, but it's wine that was initially believed to have come directly from the gods. Wine didn't become secularized on a wide scale until the Middle Ages in Europe. Wine is about 8,000 years old, but it's still evolving through new technologies and globalization. Our next guest, Paul Lucas, writes about all this and more in his new book, Inventing Wine, A New History of One of the World's Most Ancient Pleasures. He's been writing about wine for nearly 20 years and is the winner of a James Beard Award for his earlier book, American Vintage, The Rise of American Wine. He's also a professor of English at Loyola University and directs its Center for the Humanities. He spoke with Terry earlier this month.
Paul Lucas, welcome to Fresh Air. So one of the things I learned from your book is that I probably would not have wanted to drink ancient wine. You make it sound actually pretty putrid. Why did it taste so bad?
It tasted bad because fermented grape juice will oxidize very quickly. And there was no secure way to store the wine. Secure meaning keeping air away from it. So inevitably, wine would sour rapidly. And of course, it could only be made once a year at the harvest. So it might have tasted, to our palates, decent in September, but it sure would have tasted bad come spring.
And of course, you haven't tasted ancient wine, so.
No, these are all guesses.
Right.
Educated guesses, I hope.
So what are some of the things in ancient times that were added to wine to make it taste less foul?
Everything from lead to ash to myrrh to various kinds of incense, spices. And the most common thing added, especially to wines that people valued, were fresh resin from pine trees or boiled resin, namely pitch from pine trees.
You have, by saying this, not improved my impression of the taste of ancient wine. And can I say, you also say marble dust was added to wine. I can't imagine.
Correct.
Why. What function would marble dust, or worse yet, lead, serve in wine?
I'm not all that sure about the marble dust. I know that it was added. I'm not sure, since I haven't tried it myself, not being a mason, I'm not sure what it would do to the wine. Lead, in fact, will sweeten wine. So lead was used for thousands and thousands of years, all the way up until really the 18th century, to sweeten the wine which had soured due to oxidation.
And you said that wine was frequently added to water to sanitize the water because the water was so foul, drinking water. How did ancient people know that alcohol could help kill certain germs, because this was long before the idea of, you know, knowledge of germs?
I think they knew, as best I can tell, by trial and error. Pliny the Elder, writing in the Roman Empire, talks about using not water to cut wine, but wine to improve water. And he recommends using seawater, especially, and that the wine, although he does caution, don't get it too close to shore. Where one assumes the sewage went, but get the salt water and the wine combined together to make the water more drinkable. Because you've got to remember, for thousands of years, if you lived in a town or a village, the water was pretty undrinkable. If you were lucky enough to live in the countryside and you had a well, that would be a different situation. But if you lived in ancient Athens or you lived in ancient Babylon or Alexandria, you couldn't drink the water. So wine was something that people drank from morning to night. Babies drank it. Old people drank it. Soldiers drank it. Everybody drank wine all the time. And in order for them not to be falling down drunk by 10 in the morning, they mixed it with water and used it to sanitize or purify the water.
In ancient times, wine was believed to be connected to the gods. What was the connection?
I think that's the really crucial difference, even more than taste, between wine in the ancient world and wine today. Wine wasn't the only intoxicating or potentially intoxicating beverage that people drank in the ancient world. Beer and mead both came at roughly the same time. None of these were imbued with the same kind of spiritual meaning as wine. There were multiple gods of wine, Bacchus or Dionysus being the most famous one for us today, but all these cultures had gods of wine. The reason that I think they did is that wine is a completely, we would say, natural product. Unlike beer or mead or other fermented beverages, which have to be manipulated by human beings, when grapes fall to the ground and the skins burst open, yeast will start working on them right away, and wine will be produced. It may not be the prettiest wine, it may not be the cleanest wine, but wine will be produced naturally. For the ancients, naturally meant coming from God or the gods. So wine was a product of the gods, and it had this magical, mysterious quality about it. Nobody understood how it was made. It wasn't until the mid-19th century that anybody could explain fermentation. A long time away from the ancients. So it had divinity within it. And when one drank wine, one was drinking the juice of the gods. And by the time one gets to classical Greece, one was drinking Dionysus himself. One was drinking God.
It really was the connection considered to be that direct?
Yes, it definitely was considered to be that direct, which was not true with beer or mead or grog or other kinds of beverages. They were respected and they were honored, and there were gods that people thought brought human beings the knowledge of how to make beer, for example, in ancient Sumeria. But there wasn't a god of beer in the same way that there's a god of wine.
Where does wine originate?
As best we know, and this archaeological evidence is fairly recent within the last 30, 40 years, as best we know, wine begins in what geographers call Transcaucasia. That would be present-day eastern Turkey, northern Iran, Georgia, Azerbaijan, in between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, south of the Caucasus Mountains.
So some of the places that you mentioned are predominantly Islamic in population now, which means that wine is something that might not be approved of in those places, even though it's the places where wine originates.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things in that regard is that modern Islam retains the notion that is very, very old, that wine is a sacred beverage and is so sacred that it's almost too good, too powerful to be consumed on earth. The Quran is filled with references to drinking wine, floating in baths of wine after one dies. But here on earth, one is too weak to not succumb to the temptations of wine, so it's something that should be reserved for the afterlife.
What does the Old Testament have to say about wine?
The Old Testament, like the Old Testament says about many things, is somewhat contradictory at parts. But the Old Testament repeatedly talks about the Israelites as a vine and talks about Israel as a chosen place and the land where the vines will flourish, but also repeatedly condemns drunkenness, condemns wine as a secular pleasure, and says only pagans or heathens or the enemies think of wine as something that one would drink to excess, one would drink for sensual pleasure in the here and now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Lucas. He's written extensively about wine. His new book about wine is called Inventing Wine, and it's a history of wine and its sacred and social uses. You write about how spirits become a new option in around the 14th or 15th century, that beer had existed before, but so what's different with these spirits?
What happens at the end of the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance is that wine faces its first great cultural challenge. It had reigned supreme as the beverage of choice until then. Only the very poor drank beer, for example, in the early Middle Ages. The people with any sort of means, including the very beginning of the middle class, drank wine as much as they could. What happens at the end of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance is that other drinks start challenging wine's place. First is beer, because with the use of hops, which had not been used before, beer could now be transported and travel safely and had a shelf life, if you will, of more than just a few days. Before then, beer was really made by home brewers. Wasn't even much served in taverns. It was done at home by one's wife who was cooking the meal and making beer in Scandinavia or northern Germany or such places. The other big thing that happens is that distillation, which comes to Western Europe from North Africa and the Muslim world, but at first is used to make medicines and perfumes, starts being used to make drink. And distilled beverages have one great advantage over wine. They don't spoil. Whereas you open the bottle of wine and wine today, if you open the bottle of wine in a few days, it's going to taste different. And in a week, it's not going to taste very good. And in a month, it's going to be vinegar. And then yet another set of beverages comes, nothing alcoholic, but coffee, tea, and chocolate in the 17th century and into the 18th century. Nobody drew a distinction really between alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverages. These were another new enticing option for drinkers.
And at some point, you have this hybrid where wines are being mixed with spirits to get fortified wine. So what are we talking about? What drinks are we talking about?
Fortified wines begin in the 18th century, which I think of really as the period where modern wines start emerging. And they start with port in Portugal, with Madeira in the island of the same name off of the coast of Africa. And they have the advantage over still wines is that because of the addition of distillate, here usually a clear brandy, they can travel well. So you could ship the wine from the island of Madeira to the English colonies in North America, and it would still taste good. And in those colonies, there was a great passion for Madeira, for example. Philadelphia, where you're located, was a great center of Madeira drinking in the 18th century, precisely because the beverage wouldn't spoil.
One of the chapters I found awfully interesting was about the World Wars and wine. And I didn't know this. I don't know how many people know this, but trench warfare in World War I was so horrible that the European countries, and I think America as well, made sure that, you know, the boys and men in the trenches had wine.
They made sure that the boys and men in the trenches had alcohol. Different countries provided different alcohols, so that the Germans, for example, provided a lot more schnapps and beer, and the French provided a lot more wine. But a crucial government action from all the combatant countries during the First World War was making sure that the men fighting were lubricated.
And what about the Americans?
The Americans were a little more complicated because, of course, Prohibition is just around the corner and there's a huge portion of the American public that is anti-alcohol. But General Pershing, when he brings the American doughboys over, he says, let them drink. They drank wine. They drank beer. Some of the beer was provided by the government, but they also spent their own money on wine, on cheap spirits, on brandy. There really was a sense during the First World War, both for the people fighting and the people at home in Europe, that the more potent the drink, the better, because the more potent the drink, the more you could forget.
In World War II and in World War I, a lot of the wine-growing land was ruined by the war. So it's a rough period for wine after World War II.
It's a rough period for wine in the first half of the 20th century because of war, also because wine falls somewhat out of vogue. The chic drink between the wars, for example, is the cocktail, not wine. You don't see, you know, Nick and Norrell Charles in The Thin Man drinking Burgundy. You see them drinking cocktails, and lots of cocktails. Part of the story of wine is its reemergence in fashion in the second half, really the last third of the 20th century, when it becomes popular in ways that it never had been popular before.
So why does it fall out of fashion during the first half of the 20th century, and why do cocktails replace it as a sign of sophistication?
I think there are probably lots of reasons. One definite reason is that all of the world's vineyards in the end of the 19th century are decimated by a disease caused by a little microscopic root louse called phylloxera, which destroys virtually all the vineyards in the world. So they have to replant and restart making wine, but it takes a while for a new vine to start producing fruit. And secondly, there is a growing anti-alcohol movement in many places, and especially in the United States, cheap wine, jug wine, cheap fortified wine, the kind of thing that we associate with Skid Row and such, becomes a real object of attack by the anti-alcohol advocates. And I think the other reason is the first half of the 20th century in the Western world, was a pretty rough time. And, you know, the martini packs a lot more punch than a glass of champagne. And if the glass of champagne 50 years earlier was the sign of sophistication, in 1930, people wanted to toss back the martini.
During Prohibition, was it a lot easier to make distilled liquor than it was to make wine?
It was, you know, the stereotype of the moonshiners in the hills of Appalachia. It was relatively easy to distill corn or wheat or whatever crop one had into spirits, into hard liquor. It was relatively easy to make wine also, and there was a huge business in home winemaking during Prohibition because the Volstead Act that was the actual law that governed what was legal and what was illegal allowed home winemaking to a considerable degree. So especially in big eastern cities, there were great rail cars full of grapes that were shipped east from California, and people made wine in jugs, in barrels, in bathtubs, in their houses, which certainly did not, in the United States at least, after Prohibition ends in 1933, did not encourage people to think very highly about wine.
Do you remember the first wine that you ever drank?
My father was European, was Hungarian, so I grew up in a wine-drinking family. So I remember from quite a young age having little sips of wine. And I never took it as anything very special. It was only in my 20s that I began discovering the joys of wine, both physical, the sensory pleasures of wine, the smell and the taste, and the intellectual pleasures. To me, what makes wine so endlessly fascinating is that it combines hedonistic pleasure and intellectual pleasure.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. And
it's been a great pleasure.
Happy holidays. And
happy holidays to you, too.
Paul Lucas speaking with Terry Gross. Lucas is the author of the new book, Inventing Wine, A New History of One of the World's Most Ancient Pleasures. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.